Once in a while, you get shown in the light in the strangest of places if you look at it right. That's Grateful Dead. Bad and Francis had a really good start. Gotta sprinkle in a little Dead. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Jays lose 2-3 down at Wrigley in Chicago. Really fun series, though. A lot of close games. 6-5 loss on Friday afternoon. Thought they had the comeback. George Springer just missed one. It was enough to tie the game. Not enough to win it. The Jays lose it in 10 in that one. Saturday, they lose a 3-2-1 that had a couple of rain delays. Saw Addison Barger hit a ninth inning home run to draw close. Couldn't get it over the finish line there, even though Justin Steele only pitched two innings because of the delays. And then Sunday rolls around. Joey Loperfido hits a solo homer in the second inning, and turns out that's all they needed. That was all the offense for the game. A 1-0 victory on the back of yet another really good Bowden Francis start. We'll break that series down today. We'll set you up for the Reds are in town. We don't know who's pitching tonight or tomorrow because Hunter Green hit the IL and the Reds are juggling things. We know it'll be Kevin Gausman on the Jays side. We'll set you up for that series. We'll talk to Louis Paulus. We'll talk to Davey Andrews. We'll talk to Patrick Dubuque. Going kind of around the analytics and smart baseball writing community. But first, we're going to focus it on the Jays, the series that was. Arden Zwelling of Sportsnet and At the Letters was down in Chicago. How we doing, man? Good weekend?
Yeah, Before you get to the smart people, it's important to bring in the curtain jerker here. So I'm glad to be here.
It's not that. It's just the convenience of the timing here. You fresh from the work gym here.
I had a good weekend, man. It was good. Going into Wrigley, you don't necessarily expect it to be such a like weather impacted environment. But on Friday, when it was super hot, the ball was flying like crazy. Mm-hmm. Saturday, you get two rain delays, one of them unexpected, another one that lasts all of like 13 minutes. And then on Sunday, the wind was crazy. So the outfielders were all talking about how difficult it was to read balls. And a bunch of guys got into ones that, you know, got into some pitches that they thought would go and didn't. So it was like a really, it was different climate wise each game, which I wasn't necessarily expecting.
My mom and stepdad were down there for the Saturday game. And my mom texted me, "Wow, I know why they call it the Windy City now." Good joke, mom. Good joke, mom. Yeah. So eventful series in that regard. We could talk about some of the Chris Bassett of it, the going from the dome open, dome closed thing to then, by the way, you got a couple rain delays and things like that. Also a pretty good reminder though. And this question's come up a little bit in the text line and things like that. This series and who had the standout performances, both positive and negative, a good reminder that the front office might trade guys away at the trade deadline. Players don't tank, though. These players have a lot on the line. You highlighted it really well in your write-ups for sportsnet.ca across the weekend. But really, we're starting to see there is a lot on the line for these guys down the stretch.
Yeah, you really saw that on Sunday, right? I mean, Bowden Francis is pitching for everything right now. And like this goes back to his exit interview at the end of last year with John Schneider, Pete Walker, Ross Atkins, when he said like, "Hey man, I want the opportunity to be a starter. Like I'm done with this swingman stuff. Like put me on a program this off season. I'll get built up. Let me come in spring and compete for this thing. Like I feel like I've earned it." They said, "Sure, like we'll give you that opportunity, but A, you've got to build up and you've got to really get on a strong SNC program this winter. You got to prove that you can hold your stuff deeper into outings, and you need to develop something to get lefties out." It came in the spring and those things were all working, and then two starts into the year, wasn't holding the stuff, wasn't getting lefties out, boom, loses that opportunity. And like he was frustrated all year because of it. I mean, he was annoyed, he was upset, like he just was not happy with how things went. And now he has that opportunity again. Obviously he's seizing it much better now than he was prior, and he wants to keep that rolling. He was saying to me yesterday, like, "I can't stop, like I can't rest on this, like I got to keep finding ways to get better and prove I can do this."
Yeah, and I'd imagine that's the case from a running with a job perspective, and it's probably like not self-fulfilling, but it's self-motivating. You have the success, you see the results. I'd be getting back and be like, "Hey, let me get right back in there. Let me keep working on this." The success is probably pretty addicting when you have a couple of starts like that. So in terms of what's changed for him, you know, the early season stuff was like, okay, some of it's just randomness. It's too, you know, if he was Berríos or Bassett, he would have got enough starts for the ERA to normalize or whatever. But there's been a pretty significant shift in the pitch mix, both, you know, replacing the curveball with more splitter and slider, and the last two starts even introducing a two-seamer, that one with kind of the arm side run back. What have you seen from him in these, we'll call it four starts, the two Baltimore starts and then the two really good ones here, that's looked different to you?
Well, yesterday was really interesting because it was super pronounced. The splitter slider usage, very few two-seamers, very few curveballs. And with the two-seam, like, he just didn't have it, didn't feel it in the bullpen. So why am I going to throw a pitch that I'm not super confident in? With the splitter, I'm just not sure the Cubs are that prepared for it. I think they probably looked at the video of Bowden Francis and said, this is a guy who's going to try to throw a bunch of curveballs. I don't know if you can rely on that going forward, because now teams are going to know like what Bowden's doing. So he's going to have to find a way to actually bring that curveball back. I don't think this is a situation where he can be just fastball, splitter, and a few sliders going forward. Like, his curveball is good. It has been good. This year hasn't been great. He hasn't really executed it that well. And he's had to learn some hard lessons about how you can never take a pitch off at the big league level, and you can't just lay one in. Like, you have to really be convicted and fine with how you are executing that. So I think that the curveball can and will be a part of his arsenal going forward, and that's a big progress point for him going forward, is just kind of refinding that. And then if you can get to a point where it's like, hey, I've got the four seam and the two seam and the curveball and the split, and oh, hey, here's a slider every once in a while as a show me pitch, like, that's when he can really take off. But he's obviously not there yet.
Yeah, and that's when you're talking about a pitch mix where you've got all four planes of direction, right? The fastball that rides up, the splitter that ducks down, two seamer comes in, slider goes away, and then like the hitter has to cover so much of the zone, you can get away with missing one here and there. It's almost like, I mean, Justin Steele's not a perfect example, but where he throws like kind of four different four seam fastballs, it's like, yeah, I can live all over the zone because every pitch is just going to be a little different, and you've got to prepare all over the place. So cool to see 32 splitters yesterday, by far the most he's thrown. He didn't even get it up that high when he was down in AAA, and he was using it. He had told me a couple weeks ago when he came back up, it's like, yeah, the AAA catchers just kept calling it, so I just kept throwing it, but nothing close to 32. When you look at the splitter, and you're acknowledging what you said, that some games aren't going to be a 32 splitter game. You're going to need the curveball, you need the slider, but the way that it plays off of his fastball, and I think his fastball confuses people sometimes, because like 93, 94, maybe it'll touch 95. They really like the shape of it. How do those fastball and those splitter play off each other well?
Well, when he tunnels them and he disguises it well with his arm action, I mean, he kind of puts hitters in between, right? Where you got two pitches that are different velocities moving at different rates of speed, but you don't really know which one's which until it's too late. So when he's executing well and when he's fine, that's the case. I think yesterday, honestly, he left a few splitters up that caught a bit too much plate. He let a few of them run a little too much on him. And like, he told me that after the game, he's like, hey, like, I still left a few of these splitters a bit too middle. Like, it's not perfect. It's not there yet. It was effective yesterday, I think, because he had a bit of the element of surprise. I think he also got a little bit of help behind the plate from the umpire as well. But hey, like, these things are going to happen, right? If you're living generally in the zone, or like generally around kind of the shadow zone, like that one ball width off or on the plate, you can get some calls. Like, you think about that Dansby Swanson bases loaded AB, right? So what, Bowden starts him, it was either two seam or a splitter, I don't know which one, but it ran in on Dansby, right? And Dansby was like, take auto take, right? Like, no chance I'm swinging at this. I'm now count leverage with bases loaded. And I thought the really smart thing that Francis and Brian Servin did then was like, hey, this might open up the outer half of the plate. So they went back to a slider away, and Swanson,
that was the one he got a gift on, right?
Swanson took, and again, he got some help on it, but because of like Swanson being, you know, that part of the plate being open, and then him landing not so far off that, you know, Servin could still kind of present it well, he gets that call. And then now all of a sudden he's back into account, and now he goes in, out, and then back in to like put Swanson in an absolute blender with a great splitter, which again, like, maybe you got a bit of a call on it, but it was also shadow. Like, it was super borderline. So if you can live there, like, you can get some of those borderline calls to go your way. And I just thought that even just like the sequencing of that plate appearance and how Francis and Servin really worked with the hand that they were dealt there, falling behind 1-0 and kind of made like a good situation out of a bad one, missing with that first pitch, I thought that was a good like developmental step for him. I thought that really showed how he can think on the mound.
And that was his second time through the order, so those guys had seen him a little bit already. With respect to getting through the order a second time, even a third time, you mentioned it. One of the challenges for him coming into this year was carry your stuff further into the game. And a lot of that is like, a physical, you know, strength and conditioning, a fatigue element. But there's also, you know, as he adds a splitter, as he adds a two-seamer, we saw in the Angels start, the first time through the order, he pretty much just threw the four-seamer and then was able to mix things in and give guys a different look. Even if he's not a full-time five-pitch guy now, how much can that variability in his pitch mix help him get through a second time, even a third time?
I think it's really about just managing the gas tank, and that's been a difficult thing for him. He's got to learn how to, like, walk that line between not being full effort on every pitch early, but also, like I said, not taking pitches off and not letting up on the gas too much. Like, he's got to kind of, like, ride those RPMs, like, right at the red without going too far. And that's been a learning experience for him. It's something that you can only do with just having experience of starting and going deep into games and seeing a lineup for a second time and even a third time. I think some Blue Jays coaches yesterday were encouraged with the way that he held his stuff later in the game. That's why, like, he's been getting opportunities to go a third trip through and to complete seven innings two times in a row. Like, that's a huge thing for him, because reliably earlier, you know, earlier this season when he had the opportunity, and in prior years around the fourth, fifth inning, like, you saw a decline in velo and a decline in movement, and he saw some heavy breathing on the mound. So I think that Bowden has done a lot of work to put himself in a physical position where he can carry that stuff. Now it's just about understanding how to manage a gas tank over 100 pitches.
Yeah, and like he told you for your sportsnet.ca piece yesterday, you know, a lot about controlling the tempo and dictating the tempo, something you can't do as a reliever. You come into the game and that's established. You come in as a starter and you have a little bit more control over that. It seems like he's learning how to leverage that a little bit better.
Yeah, totally. He's understanding how to make the game go at his pace. And I don't think that's something that he's had an understanding of prior. You know, we see some of these starters who arrive at the big leagues at like 23, 24 and just seem to have it figured out. And we think that, why isn't everyone like that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, those are the survivors. Like, that's the 1%. Those are the outliers.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pitchers like Bowden Francis who maybe don't put it together until they're 28, 29. When did Kevin Gausman get really, really good, right? Like, pretty late in his career. When did Chris Bassett get really, really good? Pretty late in his career. So at 28, like, Bowden Francis may be putting some things together that can allow him to be like an effective mid-rotation starter going forward. I think he's learning some of those lessons now. Now it's up to him to like keep building on it.
So in terms of going forward, there's a lot of season left here for Bowden Francis to continue to make this case. Obviously the Jays are going to have Berríos, Bassett, and Gausman pretty much written in permanent marker into that rotation for 2025. You will have Bowden Francis and Yariel Rodriguez and Jake Bloss, maybe an Adam Macko also in the mix there for kind of SP4, SP5. You made the note in your piece, hey, they'll probably add to that mix from outside the organization as well. How big a leg up do you think Bowden could get the rest of the way here on one of those spots? Or is this, you know, no matter what, we're looking at a spring training competition?
I'm pretty certain he's out of options next year. Yeah, so, I mean, that helps.
Although that might only help as far as you're back to a long man. Things don't go super well,
that may push him back into a swingman role, which he hasn't exactly taken to. I know he doesn't love the changes in routine. It's a hard thing
to do.
I mean, Ross Stripling may look easy, but like there's not a lot of Ross Striplings out there who can do that. So, that could be kind of a gift and a curse sort of thing, but that does obviously give him a leg up on being on the roster in some way, in some fashion next season. And then a lot of the rest of it is just, you know, it'll depend on circumstances that we aren't aware of yet. But I do think that the Blue Jays will acquire at least one major league caliber starter. I'm sure they'd love to get another one that's like optionable or who's a more natural fit as a swingman, but maybe Francis fits into that swingman role next year and the Blue Jays do some work with him on just how to better thrive in it. Or maybe Francis is so undeniable between now and the end of the season and next spring where you just can't not give him a rotation job.
I mean, that's the ideal situation. Is he's that good and Yariel builds on and you're like, well, I don't really want to move him to the bullpen. And Jake Bloss has options, I guess. He's the one of those three guys. Because I think Yariel's not optionable next year through the terms of the deal they came with. Sorry, Jake Bloss. Yariel, he had a bit of a rough one on Friday. He had a ton of swing and miss stuff on Friday, but maybe a little less so in terms of executing those breaking balls. What have you seen from him in this kind of mostly good, but a little up and down rookie season?
Yeah, his stuff is undeniable. He set a season high in swing and miss in that outing, and it was spread pretty evenly between the different pitches, right? Like it was like 5 with the heater, 5 with the split, 4 with the slider or something like that. But the problem for him in that outing, which has been the problem for him, honestly, in every one of his outings this year, is just breaking ball command and execution on those pitches. He misses with sliders and curveballs up over the plate. You're seeing some of them here. way too often, and he gets away with it a lot because he has some of that Justin Steele-ness to him, and that his fastball can be a bit of a chameleon, right? It can take on
and the different
forms.
Leg kicks and tempos and arm angles and things like that.
Yeah, you see less of the hesitation now, but you still see the arm angle changing. Mm-hmm. And I think you still see, you know, the fastball with cut and the one that stays more true, and you know, maybe he can get like a little bit of run on it, but I don't know that you want him doing that too often. But it's not like Steele where he's like adding and subtracting cut and adding and subtracting sink. Like that's a really difficult thing to do.
Have you looked at any of the like really nerdy data sites that like show us like the spin axis and stuff like that on pitches with Justin Steele?
Not with him specifically.
His four seam is just like a big blob because there's like every other pitch is like, okay, here's a slider, here's a cutter, here's a curveball. And then his four seam fastball just takes up like the whole graph. Cause it's just like, I'm going to throw it different every single time.
That's how he gets away with. It's like 92, 93, right? It's
not. And only Gausman has thrown a fastball over the heart of the plate more often this year than Justin Steele.
Yeah, I mean, if you can like make one fastball become three different fastballs, that's a massive advantage. Like, you've had people on your show talking about how like a lot of pitchers now are trying to develop to have two fastballs,
yes,
three
sinker,
fastballs.
Cutter, four seam. You want two of the three at least.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're going to hold up as a starter, so Yariel can have that, and I think that's why he gets away with some of the hanging stuff, but. At this level, you can't get away with that for long. And he saw that against the Cubs, right? So, you know, three bombs. And at that point, it's got to be, all right, you better not walk anybody before that, or you better not allow any bloops before that. So I think that just consistently executing and commanding the breaking stuff is like the really big progress point for him. That's got to be a focus going forward.
Yeah, and it's got to be a tough thing to figure out, right? How to really bury that, but also stay in the zone enough that you're, you know, not getting back to being pitch inefficient like we saw with him in some of his early outings. While we're on the pitching note, there's a note in your piece about Jake Bloss. He threw 56 pitches on Friday at AAA. Again, no runs. I think only one or two base runners. Certainly look good. You had mentioned that his workload from here is carefully mapped out. What does that look like? And then again, you also had the note that they think he can add and hold his velocity a little better maybe in time as well.
Yeah, he's on a workload limitation going for the rest of the year, and they've got him mapped out how it's going to go. And if he's healthy, if he's effective, that's going to include major league outings later this year. I would expect him to be a September call-up, you know, when rosters expand. Mm-hmm. We'll see how things go. And yeah, when the Blue Jays got him in their pitching lab, they actually like brought him to Toronto. We all thought he went to Dunedin, but he was actually at Rogers Center after the trade deadline, just due to how the travel worked out. It was easier for him to get up here. And since the renovation, the Blue Jays have all the force plates and motion captured cameras and things at Rogers Center now. They were, I don't want to say surprised, but maybe, you know, pleasantly surprised that he's still got some room to fill out at 6'3". You know, like he's a tall frame, like a big dude, and he's still got room to add strength.
He's not a small guy now.
No, exactly. So they feel like he can add some strength this offseason with some really just deliberate work on that, and we'll see how that goes. But if he does, that would help him maintain the stuff deeper into an outing. Maybe it would help him maintain more consistent velocity. It was a bit inconsistent earlier this year in Houston's organization, and some of that could have been due to some shoulder fatigue that he was experiencing, and the Blue Jays also wanted to like check that out at Rogers Center and say, hey, like if you're pushing through something, like
let us know.
You can do that with Houston where you're in a playoff race, but with us, like, that's not a priority. Like, let's make sure this is okay. So they wanted to just get a handle on what was going on with the shoulder. And then, yeah, I think they believe that there is room for the fastball velo to tick up, or at least for the stuff to be more consistent deeper into outings, which would allow him to fulfill, like, the upside, which is mid-rotation innings eater. This isn't going to be an ace. Like, this isn't going to be your number one, number two. But he could be someone who's, like, a number three, number four, number five, who's throwing 150, 160 innings of around a league average ERA, which is really valuable. That's, like, $16 million on the open market. So if you're getting Jake Bloss doing that pre-arb and during arbitration, it's a lot of surplus value there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if a Tyler Anderson type is getting like 3 years, $39 million, you know, and you can plug that in, obviously he's having a good year, but the Jays got to him. And yeah, worth remembering as well with Jake Bloss that this guy just got drafted last year and was in high A ball to start this season. So, you know, I know people are excited to see him, but yeah, you can slow play it here a little bit. You mentioned a potential September call-up. You know, obviously, when we're talking about workloads and things like that, it's not just as simple as shut a guy down in August. You don't want to deload someone too much if you want 100, you know, you don't want to shut Kevin Gausman down at 140 if you think you're going to need him for 185 next year. Do you have a sense, though, of how September could look with respect to Berríos, Bassett, and Gausman, who are all top eight in innings pitched over the last couple seasons?
I think they have earned the right to have a pretty big say in that process and what they want to do. Like in the case of Gausman, this is a guy who's still trying to figure out his deliveries. So he's going to want opportunities to do that in games. I think Chris Bassett's going to want to end the season on a better note.
Good luck telling Chris Bassett you can't pitch today if he wants to pitch today.
Exactly. And, you know, Jose Berríos, I mean, all he knows is making every single start because he hasn't missed a start in his career. So, yeah, I think it's like it's open dialogue with those guys, but any point that they're like, I'm hanging a little bit. Yeah, I'm feeling a little bit of this. All right, take your time, you know? And anytime you can steal those guys an extra day between outings with a spot start or moving to a six-man configuration, you're going to do that.
I don't five off days in September, too.
Yeah,
a 29-game schedule.
So I don't know that you get to a point where it's like, this guy is shut down. It could, but there may be ways around that with just inserting other starters in around those guys and managing the workload down the stretch.
All right, want to move to the position player side because, again, a lot on the line for guys here. And I love the way you worded what Davis Schneider is going through right now. Navigating the labyrinth of his worst slump since high A. Man, really going through it. What have you seen with Davis Schneider? What is he saying or what is Matt Hagg saying as far as this kind of really extended slump at this point, like since the start of June, maybe even further back?
Yeah, Blue Jays coaches will tell you he's just in between, and he's missing his hittable pitches, and he's chasing the pitches that he shouldn't. And that's a tough place to be. Like Joey Votto called it a labyrinth because it's just like every turn you take, it gets worse, right? And I think that for Davis right now, like he's going to keep getting opportunities. Like it's, you know, he's a big leaguer, man. He's been a big leaguer for over a year now, and it's not like there's somebody in AAA that you can just like call up and give his spot to. So he's going to keep getting opportunities in situations the Blue Jays feel are optimal. But I think that playing time is already decreased. It could decrease even further. Like you're seeing some of it right now, like against the Cubs. I mean, you know, there were some middle pitches that he got this weekend that either fouled off or made poor contact on. And there were some off the plate away that it's just not his approach, that he never goes after when he's good, that he is going after. So that kind of tells you something about like what you know, how much he's pressing right now and just like what a labyrinth he is in. But the only way to get out of it is with opportunities to get out of it and with runway. So the Blue Jays are going to keep, you know, it's not like you're in a playoff race, so you can afford to give him opportunities to get out of this.
Yeah, and certainly against lefties, right? Like right now, you know, I don't think he started the last three games against righties because they are so lefty heavy with those Horwitz, Barger, Loperfido, Varsho, and Will Wagner are all lefties. So maybe he loses out some time on righties, but then, hey, at least you're only getting to hit against lefties. I know he doesn't have big platoon splits or anything like that. With respect to Loperfido, good reminder that this can change pretty quickly, right? Like he was in a, 4-for-36 slump to start his Blue Jays career, has turned it around a little bit, a big home run yesterday. What do you see with Loperfido when it comes to that gap that's been there? And it's early on still, but the tools to production gap where obviously he's toolsed up, right? Like he's got the long stride in the outfield. He's fast. He's got power in that bat. But so far when he's had major league opportunities, not quite there at a production level.
Yeah. He's super athletic. He's also just super intelligent about making adjustments. Like really impressed with hearing him talk about just how process oriented his approach is and just how like his attention to detail with things in his swing. And he's been working pretty hard with Matt Hagg recently on being a bit more balanced at the plate, staying back over the back leg, a bit more controlling the move forward. And he showed some really good signs of that in yesterday's game, getting around on high pitches. That's been a really big thing for him. It's kind of Davis Schneider-esque, really, where like he was getting beat with the elevated fastball.
And nobody hits Imanaga's elevated fastball, right?
Exactly.
It's the invisible. And that's the one he took for a ride.
Exactly. And after that, at the end of that 10-pitch battle that he had in his third plate appearance, he also got into an elevated fastball that, like, he just missed by a tick. But it's kind of funny because I asked him after the game, I was like, man, did you just miss that? How did, you know, was that frustrating at the end of a 10-pitch AB? He was like, yeah, I mean, look, it was 94. Like, if I make that kind of contact, if I get a barrel at the end of a 10-pitch two-strike AB, I just, hopefully it finds a gap and drops in. Sometimes I'll hit it right at a guy, but sometimes I'm going to find a gap with that thing and get a better outcome, you know? He talks like I do about the game. He calls things results and outcomes. You don't always hear that from players.
Yeah.
You know, he talks about exit velos and, like, it's just, he's an interesting guy. And I think that, you know, if anybody's going to, like, make the adjustments necessary to get the most out of their tools, it's him. Like, this isn't like a Derek Fisher type who has crazy tools but just doesn't necessarily have the baseball intellect to get the most out of it. Like, this is somebody that you want to bet on maximizing their tools just because of how they think the game and how they kind of approach making adjustments and getting better.
I don't want to, at the risk of chopping up credit and blame when we don't get to see everything, a lot of the young guys, Lo Profito coming over and then the AAA guys who come up, we've heard a lot about the work Matt Hague does with these guys, Spencer Horwitz, David Schneider at the AAA level last year, Ernie Clement unlocking some of his offense. What have you been able to pick up about Matt Hague's approach or the way he's able to, you know, with a guy like Lo Profito who speaks that particular type of language, what has made Matt Hague effective with some of these young guys?
Yeah, and Hague speaks that language too. And like a lot of the younger players in the game now just have a better understanding of like that approach to development. And a bit of the advantage that Hague has with guys like Schneider and Horwitz and Clement is that he had them in AAA, right? And in AAA, you only have the one hitting coach. So, like, he worked really intimately with these guys. You know, there's people on the Jays who are Hunter Mintz guys, you know, and he speaks their language a bit better, or who are Guillermo Martinez guys, and, you know, they just kind of vibe with him better. I think that, like, having more resources from a hitting coach standpoint, like, it's only a good thing to have one hitting coach who's responsible for 13 different hitters who all have unique needs and all need time in the batting cage. Like, there's only so many hours in the day, right? There's only so much video you can crush and so many adjustments that you can think up. So actually kind of like just dispersing that work out amongst a few different individuals, I think is actually that's an advantage for the Blue Jays.
Like, think about what you would need. Like, let's say each hitter, and I'm being charitable, this needs 15 minutes of like pregame swing and video work. If you have 13 guys yourself, we're talking 3 hours and 15 minutes for you to get through the guys pregame.
That's conservative, 15 minutes.
Yeah. And that's time. What you're doing at the AAA level. It's pretty crazy. Last one before I let you go here. You got to catch up with Nate Pearson in Chicago. Not a bad couple innings he pitched against the Blue Jays there. What
loud
did he
contact?
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, this is the Nate Pearson thing, man. Yeah. He manages to. He's like the Addison Barger of pitchers.
Yeah.
There's
all or nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. How was that? How was Nate's perspective on getting dealt? Obviously, on the Jays side, you know, it's not the outcome you want for a first round pick, but Nate Pearson probably has a major league career ahead of him still.
Oh yeah. 100%. It was good catching up with Nate. Like, I've gotten to know him really well during his time in Toronto. And like, he was pretty candid in saying he was ready for a change of scenery. Like, he felt like the team was as well. I think he got to a point earlier this year where he felt like he wasn't as much of a priority as he had been in the past.
Getting optioned with a 0.000 ERA.
What he mentioned that specifically, that number very specifically, as well as the amount of strikeouts to walks that he had at that time. And then also he felt like he was bringing the Blue Jays more ideas than they were bringing him. So like, the players are smart. They know what's going on. Nate never asked for a trade. Like, he never asked out. He didn't think that he was going to be traded at the deadline, but when it happened, he welcomed it. You know, he was happy to have just a new set of eyes, new perspective, a new environment. And like, the change of scenery thing is funny, right? Because when you say someone's a change of scenery candidate, it's usually somebody who has obvious tools, obvious potential and ability who's underperforming. So the likely thing is that that person's going to regress to the mean.
Yes.
That person's going to get better.
Hey, 100-mile-an-hour fastball with a good curveball is eventually going to find results.
So you should expect that Nate Pearson's going to perform better going forward, but he screams to me as like the Jeff Hoffman, Julian Merriweather type who puts it together at 29-30, right? Who just takes some time. Like I was saying earlier, right? Like, not everybody has this all figured out at 22, 23, 24. It's a lot of pressure, a lot of expectations to be the first round pick, to be the top 10 prospect in baseball, to have like such obvious stuff and potential, like such elite weapons, and such an amazing frame as a pitcher and ability to move on the mound and pick up new pitches really quickly, and to not like realize that immediately. But you look at Jeff Hoffman, like, similar story. He's
all-star,
like,
now
one of the top leverage relievers in the game. Julian Merriweather last year was like 70 innings of, you know, 3 ERA ball and struck out the world. So I think Nate Pearson's going to have a season like that in the future. Unfortunately, it's not going to be with the Blue Jays, but I think that for both sides, it made sense to move on. There's no ill will there. You know, I talked to Jays people this weekend who were like, we believe Nate Pearson's going to be really good. Like, we still believe he's going to figure it out. This is, you know, this is type of stuff you don't give up on. We just kind of got to a point where, like, we were out of ideas.
Yeah.
You know, we had gone way down the checklist, and clearly he had gotten to the point where he was pretty welcoming of a change of scenery as well. So Nate's, you know, he doesn't harbor any resentment towards the Blue Jays for the way that things played out, but he's pretty happy to be where he is right now.
And we'll see if Yohindrick Pinango can turn into anything.
Josh Rivera is the other one,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we'll likely organizational guys.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Okay. On the other end of guys who take a little while to figure it out, Ellie De La Cruz this year, he's 22 years old and already has accrued 5.5 WAR this season. Should be a fun series. You'll be on the TV sideline for this one.
Yes. If he gets one more steal this year, he becomes one of only 5 players in the history of the game with 20 homers and 60 steals in a season. And that's like with, you know, Ricky Henderson and Joe Morgan, like unbelievable names. So if he does that, that'll be pretty cool. You'll be witnessing like, so, you know, something that you really just do not see in the game anymore.
Well, and a starter tonight in Kevin Gausman, who is not particularly effective at controlling the running game. So we might get number 60 tonight. Arden, thanks for taking the time, man. See you down at the park later.
Thanks, Blake.
All right. Arden Zwelling of Sportsnet, of At The Letters. He will be on the TV broadcast for this series on the sideline. I will continue to get you set up for that one. It's a 7:07 start tonight. Kevin Gausman against TBA. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we'll talk about this idea that Major League Baseball has kind of intentionally leaked to baseball media to get to see what fans think about it, see what everyone thinks about it. Could you mandate pitchers having to go at least 6 innings to kind of get offense back in the game and change how we treat and develop pitchers? We'll see. We'll talk about it next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays dropped 2 of 3, but a nice 1-0 victory against the Cubs. A couple starters in that game didn't go 6 innings. Major League Baseball is kicking around the idea. Reportedly, Jesse Rogers of ESPN had this, and then a few others had some details as well. Major League Baseball is reportedly kicking around the idea of, well, in a few years, what if we mandated a 6-inning minimum for starters, unless certain criteria are met to hook a starter early? The game would look pretty different. In fact, it's such an outlandish idea, or such a, you know, kind of sticker shock idea, at least, that when I mentioned it heading into break, Arden looked at me before he left. He was like, really? So yeah, that's kind of the response. Our next guest wrote up his response to it. It's Louis Paulus of The Lose Letter, former Phillies quant analyst and consultant for multiple major league teams. Lou, what's going on, man? How are you?
Doing well, thanks. How are you?
I am good. Before we get into the 6-inning minimum stuff, since we last spoke to you, I mean, you've worked for baseball teams, you have the newsletter and things like that. You've also just been like, I'm also going to become a food writer. How is the food critic, food writer life treating you?
It's doing great for my stomach. We'll see about the rest of me. But I've always loved food and I've always liked writing. So it happened that I started doing both in the same hobby. You can also find me, I guess, if I'm plugging this ahead of time, on Instagram at Louie the Foodie, with both Lou and food spelled with EW instead of 2 O's. So if you want to hear me talk about things that aren't baseball, you can get my food writing there.
There we go. We'll check that out. Let's talk about your baseball stuff, though. Again, at the Lose Letter newsletter, obviously, you wrote up, okay, what would this look like? What are some of the problems with it? What are some of the things we like? So for anyone who missed it, it was Jesse Rogers of ESPN first had the news initially. And basically, it's the MLB is at least kicking around the idea of what would a 6-inning minimum for starting pitchers look like. You could only get hooked if you went 6 innings, if you threw 100 pitches, if you allowed 4 earned runs, or if you got hurt, and then an IL stint would be mandated after that point. So initially you hear this, and we'll get into some of the detail of your write-up, but what is your, like, snap reaction to it when you see it come down?
Yeah, so my snap reaction to it is this feels like yet another idea in the long line of ideas we've heard and even seen implemented in the attempts to cut down on strikeouts and put more in-play action back in the league. And the important thing to note about this, and that this is the trick that's befallen some of the proposals that we've seen, is that you have to understand the reason why strikeouts have gone up so much in the last few years. You go back a couple decades, there's been a pretty stark trend up. And the basic thing I would say is that it comes down to an imbalance in incentives between the pitchers and the hitters, that it is more important to pitchers to get strikeouts than it is for hitters to avoid strikeouts, which doesn't mean that hitters like striking out. Hitters hate striking out. But it is a lot easier to be a good hitter in the modern game if you strike out a lot than it is to be a good pitcher in the modern game if you don't strike out many batters. And especially with the advances in analytics of understanding what makes players valuable, and even the last few years, you know, within the last decade of pitch tracking data being widely available, teams have much better ideas, not just of how important strikeouts are, but how to get strikeouts. And that's why you're seeing higher velocity, more movement on fastballs. You're seeing more breaking balls used. And as a result, hitters are just not putting the ball in play as much. And if you make make pitchers throw at least six innings, that does get to some of the incentive behind that we are seeing pitchers go fewer innings because they are pitching less efficiently because they're trying to get strikeouts instead of trying to induce weak contact. So if you force pitchers to throw six innings every time, you're going to incentivize throwing a little bit less hard, maybe throwing fewer breaking balls, trying to get more balls in place so that you can get outs more efficiently. So in that case, it is actually one of the better proposals I've heard, I think, in terms of trying to address the strikeout problem. But of course, there are some other major issues that this plan has that would lead to other ripple effects besides adding more action into the game.
Yeah, and look, it would add offense, certainly, and it's an important distinction you make, is that the league is not necessarily trying to adjust just offense. They could just rejuice the balls if they wanted to do that. We've seen them do it, or I mean, they won't admit it, but we've seen them credibly accused of doing it. They want more ball in play. They want more action. That means cutting down on the strikeouts. And there is a pitcher injury component to this as well, I think. And that is that, you know, part of what you're talking about, the way that strikeouts are incentivized for pitchers, everyone trains for that. Everyone is throwing 100% and you're trying to get the maximum velocity and the maximum spin and break every single pitch. Well, when you train for that, you know, naturally guys are going to get hurt a little bit more. They're not going to be as durable when you're pushing the body to that limit. This would be a longer term thing. We would have to change how we're identifying pitchers, how we're developing pitchers in the minor leagues and college and high school and things like that. This would be like a longer window shift. What do you think of the proposal, though, from specifically the angle of could it curb pitcher injuries in time by reorienting how pitchers are trained and incentivized?
Sure, it could. I think there's a sense that if pitchers are throwing less hard generally, that could lead to fewer injuries. I think, though, that maybe that effect, for those who like the study, is maybe overstated, because it's not as though pitching injuries aren't new. People got hurt, their arms got sore long before anybody knew what FIP and spin rate were. And you're still going to see pitchers throwing harder than probably they used to, and you'll see them throwing more breaking balls than they probably used to. They might dial it back a little bit to try and get to six innings, but it's not like we're going to be playing slow pitch softball. The flip side, I'd also say, and this is something this is maybe the biggest thing I'm worried about with this plan, is that a lot of times if a pitcher leaves before the sixth inning or before the seventh inning, if it could be in the sixth inning, but they haven't actually pitched that poorly, it's a precautionary measure. That if a pitcher is seeing their velocity dip more than you expect after a few innings, or they're struggling to find their command, or they don't seem fully right, a lot of times a team will take them out earlier than, you know, the scorebook might say they should if they're having a quality start. But the smart thing to do, because if a pitcher is starting to get gassed beyond the normal level of tired you have after your pitching, that's when injuries are probably more likely to happen. When you're exerting yourself through the pain or through the soreness, if you move a little bit differently, if you push yourself a little bit too hard, that's when you get hurt. I mean, obviously you get hurt other times too, but that's one of the best ways to get hurt, is to try and ignore the pain and pitch through it and exert yourself through it and make your body compensate for the soreness you're feeling. So if you are making those sorts of pitchers who aren't yet injured, but could be if you work them too hard, if you're making them stay in the game and pitch longer, you're going to lead to them some, you know, light soreness or minor fatigue could lead into something more serious and they could end up on the IL.
Yeah, and you certainly don't want that. It would go the opposite direction of what we're trying to do here. And there are a lot of potential, you know, a rule change this extreme. And look, the likely takeaway here is that baseball's kicking around some ideas and they wanted to know what the public thought about this one. They wanted people like you writing up, hey, here are the red flags. So let's kick around some of the specifics here. In terms of lowering that strikeout rate, if that is, you know, if the two goals are pitcher injuries and let's get some offense back in the game via limiting how much everything is about strikeouts, what else could they look at in your estimation? I know this is something you've written about in before, the hit by pitch tax, an additional one there for pitchers. What are some other ways baseball could explore to get some of that offense back in, de-incentivize or disincentivize the strikeout above all else for pitchers?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the use of de-incentivize is really key there because unless you're doing something like banning sliders or setting a velocity limit, the idea has to be how do you find a way to either make strikeouts less tolerable for hitters to make it so you can't have Aaron Judge do Aaron Judge things while still be one of the top three strikeout hitters in the American League. Or you have to find a way to make strikeouts less appealing for pitchers and disincentivize that sort of approach. So the idea that I have been pushing for a few months now is, I guess you mentioned, the hit by pitch tax, which is a nice pithy way to put that. I should use that. I haven't had a short version of it before. But the idea that I have come up with is an automatic ejection for any time a pitcher on the same team beans two batters in one game. And the idea behind this is hit by pitches have actually exploded in recent years alongside strikeouts. It's not a perfect one-to-one correlation, but you've seen the last few years have been the highest hit by pitch years in modern baseball history, while they've also been among the highest strikeout years in modern baseball history. And I see those two as linked because the pursuit of strikeouts has led to a priority of velocity and stuff over command, which is not a judgment of what should be the case, is the way some people make it, but it is just sort of an observation about how the game has gone. And if you're throwing harder and you are less worried about where it's going, because even if it's down the middle, a really fast fastball is hard to hit, that leads to more pitches missing your spot, which leads to more hit by pitches. So if you make hit by pitches costlier to the point where you have to avoid them more thoughtfully, that makes you have to think a little more thoughtful about your command. It means you can't just throw the ball very hard and have no idea where it's going, or you risk getting ejected far earlier than the sixth inning in this proposal. It means you have to be a little bit more careful about pitching up and in, which is one of the most effective places for velocity to be pitched in the strike zone. If you sort of pretend you're swinging the bat, you can sort of understand how the hardest place to get to hit a fast pitch is up and in. That's where most bean balls are with fastballs. So if pitchers have to be a little bit more circumspect about throwing there, that makes everything easier for the hitter. And it also means that you have a little bit more variability in when the pitchers, or how long the starter will be in the game. And this is actually something that the sixth inning rule works to the detriment of, that if you have a risk of your starter being pulled in the second or third or fourth inning more than usual, you have to keep more relievers fresh in your bullpen, and they can't be throwing max effort for 15 pitches and then they're done. So if you design your bullpen to be able to cover more length, which is, again, the opposite of what the sixth inning rule change would do while it's making starters go longer, you'll have to pitch more conservatively and have your relievers save their bullets.
Yeah, so it's a fascinating one. And I think, again, whether it's that one or something like it, the idea here is, you know, you have to change the incentive structure. The other thing I wanted to kick around with you about the MLB idea, and again, I don't think this is serious enough that we need to get, like, I mean, we're doing a segment on it, but it's mostly because it's fun to talk about, not because this change is about to come. But the other thing that could happen with the six inning rule, and again, the requirements would be, you have to go six innings unless you throw 100 pitches or allow four earned runs or, again, get hurt and have to hit the IL. The four runs at 100 pitches thing gets really, really interesting in terms of, like, shady incentives or externalities, right? Like in basketball, we're up three in the closing seconds, we'll foul. Nobody wants to see that. That's not a great way to end the game, but the incentive structure and the rules at play at that point in the game make it the smart strategy. What kind of things could you see playing out? Let's say Major League Baseball did roll this out. Are we going to see, you know, would we see a team maybe concede a run to be able to get their pitcher out of there? A pitcher embrace being less pitch efficient later in a start so that the hook option is there?
Yeah, that's exactly the comparison I was going to make was to basketball, that I'm not a big basketball guy. And one of the big reasons for that is that I just hate the end of the game when you're seeing the intentional fouls. And I understand it's smart strategy and I get it. And if my job were to analyze basketball strategy, I probably would endorse that in situations where they use it. But as a spectator, I don't like watching teams try not to do the right thing all the time, to try not to win every play. And I think it's a little bit more extreme. You wouldn't see this very often, or maybe ever, hopefully, if this rule were implemented. But you're right. You open up a structure where it's plausible to picture a scenario where the best thing a team can do is to give up runs quickly. That if you have a pitcher who I mentioned, if they're out of gas, but they're nowhere near 100 pitches yet, but you're worried about them pitching too long, if you already have a big lead or it already is looking like a blowout, do you just walk in a couple runs to get them to four earned runs? Because that's the fastest way to get them out of the game. Again, I think it's you have to bend yourself a little bit to find a situation where that would make sense. But I worry about having any situation where you could find yourself in a spot where the team's incentivized to allow runs intentionally or to waste pitches intentionally. Baseball is pretty good about avoiding that, at least on the micro level within games. And I would really hate to have a situation where baseball starts doing the foul at the end of the game thing in basketball or in football, you see players dive short of the end zone if they want to milk the clock. Baseball doesn't really have that sort of thing. And this would open the door just a crack for that to possibly happen in the future.
Which is, it introduces, it's fun for sports radio to talk about whether you should have done that, what's the right call there. But it's never good when the incentives are not built to 100% try to win and maximize every opportunity. Louis, before we let you go here, I did want to ask, you're a Cleveland guy. Guardians looking okay. It's a pretty tough race in the AL Central. It's a pretty tough race for the top of the American League. But this Guardians team has floated near the best record in baseball for the better part of this season. How are you feeling about their chances here, maybe 6 weeks out from the playoffs?
Yeah, it's been a fun year in Cleveland. I know a lot of family and friends are still there who are big Guardians fans, and they're ups and downs, because every baseball season is ups and downs, and every fan thinks that their team is uniquely frustrating. But big picture, even Cleveland fans have to admit that things have gone pretty well this year. They have such a well-defined system in Cleveland. I was thinking about this, that I don't think there's been an outside hire for Cleveland's top baseball ops executive in my lifetime. You go straight from Hank Peters to John Hart to Mark Shapiro before he went to Toronto to Antonetti and Chernoff. They have been doing things pretty well with good continuity for decades. And a lot of the things they do have worked really well. And so a lot of fans know the Guardians have a pretty clear style. They like their middle infielders with field to hit. They feel like they can get the most out of pitchers, make them throw harder or improve their breaking balls. They're one of the best reputational teams in the league at that. But another thing that they have done a lot that I don't know if folks outside of Cleveland fully appreciate is they have really put an emphasis on clubhouse chemistry and veteran leadership in a way that I think flies in the face of at least the stereotypes of how a lot of analytical and smart teams run their organizations. You've seen them keep a lot of older players around who aren't the most skilled anymore, but they have that leadership that makes the team looser and they think play better. And we're really seeing this, I think, this year. That's the explanation they're giving. There was a great piece in The Athletic this week about, or I guess last week at this point. This is one of the things that Stephen Vogt, the new manager, has been doing since he was, for a while, one of those players who was highly regarded for his clubhouse ability and leadership. He was a pretty good player, too, but sometimes more than his actual on-field skill. And so I think he's brought that atmosphere to the clubhouse, and it sounds silly and simple to say they're doing well because they're loose and happy, because usually winning makes you happy. But when you think about the strategies they've had and the consistency they've had in that approach towards trying to build that in the clubhouse for years, maybe that's what's paying off.
Yeah, there's always a bit of a chicken or the egg. Are things loose because you're winning, or are you winning because they're loose? But show me the team that does really well and is tight and unhappy in the clubhouse. I don't imagine we've seen many of them. Lou, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Really appreciate it, and keep up the great work.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you having me.
Louis Paulus of the Lou's Letter, formerly with the Phillies and a consultant for a couple of different Major League Baseball teams. You can check out his baseball work at the Lou's Letter. And yeah, a lot of good food content on his Twitter and Instagram as well. If we had more time with him, I would have asked what it's like for a Cleveland person. And Grady Sizemore played for the Phillies too, who Louis worked for. To see Grady Sizemore behind the bench for the White Sox. Now, we'll talk about that a little later in the show, maybe, because Patrick Dubuque, who will join us at 11:30, loves writing eloquently about bad teams like the White Sox and the Rockies. Right now, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to take a check-in on another AL Central team, see how the Minnesota Twins are doing. Edouard Julien, the Canadian, is back getting a third crack at the majors this year. We'll kind of whip around baseball with Davey Andrews and Patrick Dubuque as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays back in action tonight against the Reds for three, and then the Angels are here for four. Just saw an awful lot of a not very good Angels team. We'll get four more of them. But first, the Reds, including Ellie De La Cruz, who is a ton of fun. Let's take a look around Major League Baseball here. Not a lot of Jays talk in this next segment. Maybe we're joined by our pal of Fangraphs, researcher at MLB Network, Davey Andrews. Davey, what's up, man? I remember seeing a tweet. You got a new baseball glove recently. What is your break it in process? I know everyone's got their own, you know, the oil, the under the mattress, the oven. Everyone's got kind of their own approach here. What are you doing to break this in?
You know, the truth is this is the first new glove I've gotten since I was a high schooler, so it's close to 20 years. So I don't know. I've just been pounding a ball in it until my hand hurts. I used a tiny bit. I don't have any glove oil, so I used a tiny bit of sunflower oil for my kitchen. I don't have a technique, but I did use it in a game. No errors, so that's a good place to start.
Wow, it's bold to use a new one unbroken in a game. I feel like I would be like excited about it. I would be playing catch with it, warming up with it. And then like when I went to take the field, I'd be like, gotta use the old faithful here.
Well, the truth is it was sorely overdue. The old glove is such a pancake that I couldn't backhand the ball anymore. So anything is better.
All right. Backhand the ball. Where are you playing in the field, by the way?
These days, a lot of short third.
Okay.
Sometimes center. It's adult league softball. So it's like if you're willing to sacrifice your body, which I'm all too willing to do as a 40-year-old, then you can play anywhere.
All right. Positional versatility, like our friend Edouard Julien, who is back for the Minnesota Twins. Not a great segue there, but I did not have a better way to steer us to the Minnesota Twins. Look, we've talked about Edouard Julien before. He's had a bit of a pretty up and down season. Obviously didn't start the year very well. Got a quick call up in July, but right back down. And now he's here again because Carlos Correa can't stay healthy. Byron Buxton can't stay healthy. There's an opportunity here. What are you looking for from Edouard Julien to get back to some of what made him such a fascinating rookie last year?
I mean, I would say the first thing I'm looking for is some aggression, and in both in terms of swinging more often and pulling the ball, because he really has only at the big league level, when he has pulled the ball, he has only been rolling over to second base. He just hasn't been able to lift the ball in the air. So I think that's the big indicator for me. He's had a ton of called strike threes, and so it's sort of about getting back to he was always a person with great plate discipline, but he seems to have drifted into passivity. And so it's about, can he swing like he was last year?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because like obviously, you know, being passive is bad. Being selective can be good, but there's, we'll call it the Kevin Biggio line, right? Of like, if you,
exactly.
If you go, and I don't mean this to pick on Biggio, but if you go past a certain point of, well, we know we can just attack you in those situations, or you're not doing enough damage, so we don't have to pitch carefully around you. You know, a 12% walk rate isn't all that valuable if you're striking out 40% of the time and you're getting called strike threes a lot of the time.
Exactly. I mean, and that's the thing. And I don't think Julien is at that point, even though they're both toward the top in called strikeouts, Biggio and Julien. I don't think he's at that point where people are coming right after him. But I do think that when he sees his pitch, he's not coming after it like he did. You know, if you look at his spray chart last year, he hit tons of home runs to left center and right center. And this year, they're all left center. And so there's just something where I think when something isn't going his way, maybe he's waiting back a little too much, and I don't know how they fix that. I think what's happened hasn't been what the Twins wanted. You know, they wanted him to go down and really kind of figure things out and force his way back up. And then injuries have made it so that that hasn't been possible. They've kind of had to jerk him back up and down twice now. And I'm not sure once someone comes off the IL whether he'll stay on the roster. And I can't imagine that's how they want things to go. You know, I think they really want him to hit his way back, because the people that I've been able to talk to, they really do believe in him. They think he's a good kid with a good head on his shoulders, and the people in the clubhouse really love him. And so they fully believe in him that he can go back and fix this. But I think what's gone on the last couple of weeks maybe hasn't been helping him to figure it out.
And it's tough. Like, I'm not locked in watching St. Paul AAA games, but I can look at the stat line and you see he goes down there and he's walking 20% of the time. And you're, you know, first blush, you're like, well, how can that not be good? And it's like, well, he's doing no damage. Like, his OBP is almost right. Higher than his slugging. And it, like, mm-hmm. If I'm the Twins, I probably want him going down there and attacking more and be like, look, the results aren't like, results are important, but like, if you take a few less walks because you're being a little more aggressive and you're trying to jump on stuff, maybe that's the better path back to him. So it's got to be a tough one if you're Edward Julian, because like, hey, I can get on base, like a 20% walk rate, almost a 400 OBP down at AAA. It's got to be tough to pivot away from that.
Absolutely. And it's also, and you know, I don't know what the Twins have been telling him when they sent him back down. I don't know what the instructions were, or whether it's just, hey, get your head on straight, we believe in you. You know, if it were me, I might have gone for something a little bit more drastic. Like I wrote a couple weeks ago, I sort of said, give him the chance and tell him, hey, I don't want you to walk today. I want to see four at bats where you go out and attack the ball. And I just want you to kind of get into that mindset of selective aggression where you can wait for your pitch, but I want you going after him. And maybe the Twins, that's kind of an extreme thing to tell someone who was a major contributor last year. You know, he was a huge hitter. He was huge for them in the playoffs. So I can understand why they chose not to monkey with him in that way. But I worry that, you know, it's a full season where he's below average at the plate. And this is a guy who if he's going to be valuable to the team, it's going to be with the bat. And so I think there is a clock where they don't want him struggling that long, and they do want him to be a valuable bat coming into the home stretch of the season in the playoffs.
Yeah, and they need him right now. They're in a playoff race. Byron Buxton got that cortisone shot in his hip. Carlos Correa is only just starting to run at full speed, dealing with that plantar fasciitis, which, you know, I'm not a Major League Baseball player. I've had that before as a runner, like right. 30 pounds ago. But yeah, it's not an easy thing to come back from. So they need it right now. High level with this Twins team. This is a pretty tight race in the AL Central. It's a pretty tight race in the AL Wild Card. For anyone who's not caught up, the Twins are just back of the Guardians right now, two games back. They are a game up on the Royals. So the AL Central right now has three playoff spots, which pretty surprising there. How are you feeling about the Twins generally? And I guess the nice thing here being after the Royals, there's now a pretty sizable gap before the Red Sox.
Right. I mean, although the Red Sox are charging and they look very good right now. So I alternate between being alarmed and really confident. Like when you look at this Twins roster, there are so many good players, and Buxton's injury, they don't seem that worried about it. And Correa, they're not going to force him to play through it the way that he chose to do last year. They really want him to get healthy so that he's 100% when he returns. So when you look at this roster, you think, okay, well, if at the right time they have a healthy Buxton who's having a great year, they have a healthy Correa who's having a great year, and you know, Royce Lewis is Royce Lewis, and Jose Miranda is putting up a great year, and Willie Castro is breaking out, and Carlos Santana has found the fountain of youth, and all of a sudden Trevor Larnach is hitting, and Christian Vasquez is hitting, and Kyle Farmer just seems to have started hitting out of nowhere, and all of a sudden this is an extremely scary lineup where there aren't that many places to hide. So in the one hand, I think, man, this is a close race, and a lot depends on the pitching, especially with Joe Ryan out with an injury. And on the other hand, I think this is a team that nobody is going to want to face come October. So I am confident and terrified at the same time, which I feel like is a good way to sum up baseball fandom as a whole.
Yeah, I think so. You're either confident and terrified, or you are just very, very mad at your team constantly. Those are the only two. And then I guess there's like probably some White Sox and Rockies fans who have just like tuned out entirely, and they're watching for very specific things. Here's a White Sox question for you. How differently would this America, and I know you wrote about this, so I'm teeing it up like I just thought of the idea, but I know you already wrote about it. The AL Central has three teams in playoff spots right now, and they're juking it out. Even with the more balanced schedule now in baseball, those teams have had a lot of Chicago White Sox. How would things look differently if the White Sox, I mean, if we just booted them out of the league, or if they were just like a more reasonable team?
Well, the Guardians would be psyched. They are 5-5 against the White Sox, or they were when I wrote this. They haven't played them since. Both the Royals and the Twins are 11-1 against the White Sox, so they have made the most of their opportunities. It's got to be brutal if you're the White Sox, just facing two of your main rivals and losing 22 of 24 games. But so all of a sudden, if you remove those games, it's a much closer playoff race. It's that final wild card spot. There's three teams that are really in there. So it was very hypothetical. You could do that with any team in any season. It's just that the White Sox are so extreme, and the Guardians, for whatever reason, haven't been able to capitalize the way that those other two teams have. And, you know, there's a lot of randomness in baseball, but it would be a very different look in the Central. And thank God for the Guardians that it's only 12 games this year and not 18.
All right. Okay, last Twins one before we pivot off of them. Zebby Matthews made his debut last week. He's going to pitch again today against the Padres. What did you see from him in that first one? Obviously, this came about for rough reasons. Joe Ryan, Chris Paddock, and Anthony DeSclafani all on the IL. But where's the excitement level with Zebby Matthews here as he makes his second go-around?
It is extremely high. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, he's a ranked prospect, and when you look at his stuff metrics and stuff from AAA, you think this guy could pitch in the big leagues right now. So for him to come out and just absolutely perform in the way that he did, it's really, you know, he was lights out except for a home run, and he didn't have that many strikeouts, but he had plenty, and he showed a lot. So I think the excitement level is really high. Obviously, the Padres are a very good team, and so I think this will be a very different challenge, but I think anybody who tells you they're not excited by what they saw last week is lying to you.
Can you think of any prospect? 7 walks in 102 innings this year for Zebby Matthews so far. Like he makes Zach Eflin look wild. It's pretty crazy. Man, I mean, like, this is Zebby Matthews specific, but in general, when a pitcher has that level of command, I mean, in terms of a foundation to build the skill set, but obviously if these are all meatballs, that's a problem. But that to me suggests like a pretty advanced level of pitching for a 24-year-old.
Absolutely. And it's not just command. It's also the ability. Everybody's going to miss the zone sometimes. And so it's the ability that when you do miss the zone, those are pitches that people want to swing at. And he seems to have it. You know, it's really exciting. I cannot think of anyone off the top of my head who just came up with that level of control. It's not unique, but it's very exciting, you know, to be throwing George Kirby and whoever around. It's these are exciting times.
Yeah. Look, Greg Maddux, maybe back in the 80s when he was in the minors, I don't know. He had like a 2.2% walk rate at one point, but 7 walks in 102 innings is even lower than that. So, I don't know. Obviously, you know, that's a 10 millionth percentile outcome, Greg Maddux for Zebby Matthews. But anytime Greg Maddux comes up in the search, you're doing something. You're doing something pretty right. Okay, I said we were going to pivot off the Twins. I'm not done kicking the Chicago White Sox though. You wrote this up, and we should have talked about it last week because it happened last week. But I'm still flabbergasted by Grady Sizemore, new Chicago White Sox manager, intentionally walks Juan Soto to face Aaron Judge, and Aaron Judge obliterates a pitch for a home run immediately. You wrote it up. You broke it down a little bit. Can you put us in Grady Sizemore's head? What's the thought process there?
Well, I assume, first of all, we should right off the bat, Grady Sizemore is in an impossible situation. I do not want to pick on the guy at all. I don't know how, you know, this is his first year as a coach at all. It's his second year as a full-time front office official in any way. And so I don't want to pick on the guy. This is an impossible situation. But it's hard, you know, like the game has pivoted away from intentional walks for a reason. The numbers just tell you that they're not going to work. And walking someone in front of the best player in baseball is a new strategy. We'll say that. So I think one way to flip this would be that Grady Sizemore is a really bold guy. I think what happened, honestly, is in the 8 plate appearances before that intentional walk to Soto, Soto had breached base 7 times with 3 walks and 4 home runs. So I think it was just one of those, like, we can't let this guy beat us again moments. But it looks bad, and I think they poked the bear a little bit. Aaron Judge is a very patient guy, and they threw him 4 pitches off the plate, and he just decided on the last one, you know what, I could hit this.
Yeah, it's very Mr. 3000 of him. I'm just going to reach out there and get it. If you don't want me to get my 3000th hit off you, I'll reach out there and get it then. And yeah, you...
Mr. Baseball, too.
Yes, as well. Juan Soto, he had been killing them, but Aaron Judge literally... has offensive numbers right now when we contextualize for league environment. You got to go back to Bonds for the last time someone's doing this. Man, what do you make of Judge and Soto? I mean, obviously as a duo, like we're seeing, they're creating almost 40% of the Yankees offense themselves. We've never seen anything like that. You might have to go back to like Lonely Island as Mark McGwire and Jose Canseco for the last time a duo put up numbers like this. Are the Yankees a really good team, or do they have 2 really good players? Like, what do you make of that aspect of it?
I mean, I think the answer to that question is yes.
Yeah.
They regardless of where they're getting it, and I understand it's 40%, which is crazy, they have the best hitting line in baseball. They have a 118 WRC plus as a team, which is the best in baseball. They're the best offense in baseball. And I know that they're getting it from those particular 2 guys, but it's working. And they also, I think Giancarlo Stanton is quietly having a pretty great year with the bat. He's got 20 home runs and he's almost on pace for 40 if you remove the time that he's sat and been injured. And then Austin Wells has also come up and been fantastic, both defensively and offensively. And Jazz Chisholm is a big loss. He really added a piece that they needed. And so, like, having that disappear so quickly really hurt. But they're a really solid team. You know, Fangraphs has them ranked 7th in terms of team defense. And, you know, Garrett Cole is starting to look great. And, you know, like, they have players like Anthony Volpe, who's not hitting the way they hoped, but he's so valuable with the glove that he's a real contributor either way. It's, you know, from the beginning of the season, I remember looking when we had to make our preseason picks. I remember not believing in the Yankees that much and then kind of diving into the projections and saying, okay, well, I guess I was wrong here. Like, it seems like things are going wrong and it doesn't matter. So it's hard to count out a team like that because you know, the playoffs are all about who gets hot. And if they get hot, there's kind of no team that you should believe in more than them.
Yeah. And it's I'm setting that question up in a bit of a glib way, you know, to make it seem like it's just 2 guys. They employ those 2 guys. Even if the answer was they're only good because of those 2 guys, which isn't true, you still have those 2 guys and you got to pitch to them in a playoff series. So good luck. They also have a pretty good bullpen, you know, with Clay Holmes at the front of it. And then that goes 5 deep. They just called up Tim Mesa the other day, old friend here in Toronto, and even a guy like Tim Hill, who's just a ground ball machine. So they've got some, you know, versatility of role and skill set there in the bullpen. Fangraphs has them at 15% odds for the World Series. That is second best in baseball, narrowly behind the Dodgers. And perhaps most interesting, it's a good chunk ahead of the Baltimore Orioles. Now, the Orioles saw the biggest jump in World Series playoff odds at the deadline based on Dan Zimborski's Zips-based ones. They're still at a pretty healthy, like, 8.5% there. But those 2 teams are tied today. When you see a 15% versus 8.5% World Series odds for the Yankees and Orioles, respectively, but they're tied in the standings, how do you feel about that and the accuracy of that versus how these 2 teams feel next to each other more, like, qualitatively?
Right. I mean, accuracy is always going to be a stretch. These are estimates and projections, and there's a lot that you don't know, and health is a huge factor. But I think it also speaks to exactly what we're talking about with the Yankees lineup, that when you have your production locked into a few guys, then they can really carry you in a small series. And so the Yankees have a legit ace in Gerrit Cole. And the Orioles, you know, like, you don't have to throw as many starting pitchers in the playoffs. And so the Yankees, you can see getting some real production. I think what it says is that the Orioles starting rotation isn't as solid or isn't as dependable in that way. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't have a good couple weeks from some very solid players and carry them through. But in a big game, you know, give me Gerrit Cole is, I think, what that really says.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. I did want to ask you about Trevor Rogers as well, but I'm going to pivot here because we wanted to have some fun with something that we haven't got to talk about on air yet, but we've kicked around in the DMs, the Adam Dunn hat trick. So I'll use this as a pivot. Aaron Judge has done an Adam Dunn hat trick 14 times this season. For anyone who doesn't know, this is my take years ago on the Gordie Howe hat trick for baseball. The three true outcomes taking over, strikeout, walk, and home run. So an Adam Dunn hat trick is you hit a homer, you strike out, and you get walked all in the same game. It's actually Mark McGwire and Aaron Judge share the record for most in the same season. I guess, first of all, I just know this is something you like. What's front of mind for you when you look at the leaders on this right now? And I also, by the way, there is an intentional walk version of it, but Judge has only done that three times this year, Judge and Shohei. So they're not, McGwire had seven of those 1 year with the intentional. What are you looking for on the Adam Dunn hat trick leaderboard this year?
Well, the real truth, and first of all, it sounds like you got your stat head login back, so I'm very happy for you.
I didn't want to air that out on air, but I'm back in there. Yep.
So I think the big thing to look for here is there's a name. I have a bunch of different leaderboards. I have the all-time leaderboard in front of me. I have the season leaderboard. I have a couple. The big name that I don't see anywhere is Joey Gallo. And I think what the Adam Dunn hat trick speaks to really well is longevity. Like, when you look at this list, it's just some of the best sluggers of all time, because, man, you gotta, the home run is the limiting factor here. Anybody can strike out, and to some extent anybody can walk, but it's those home runs and it's staying on the field. So, like, Giancarlo Stanton is creeping up. He's 17th all time with 83, but it's staying on the field is really important. Joey Gallo does it all the time, but you got to stay on the field. I mean, the other big name that I think is a real mover on this list is Kyle Schwarber. You know, he's got 59 all time, which ranks 51st, but he could have another 50 homer season next year easily, and all of a sudden he's way up there.
Yeah, it's a tough one. It's, look, you don't get on there for no reason. It's I think the most surprising one to me, and I guess it's because he didn't quite strike out at like a Mark McGwire level, is like, I thought Bonds would be all over this thing, but he really didn't strike out much, which is crazy for his hitter profile.
People were afraid to throw him strikes with great reason. The other name that I think is really fun, and who has, since you published this in 2013, is the only real change to the top 10 all time. Mike Trout has snuck in there at 10. It's become more of his game in the last couple of years. He's become more of a slugger who strikes out a fair amount and less of an all-around hitter.
Okay, so here's...
I also want to note Edwin Encarnacion and Jose Bautista are, former Blue Jays, are tied for 56th place all time, which I think is adorable.
Nice.
Teammates on an important leaderboard here.
Yeah, I mean, they're linked in Blue Jays history and linked in Adam Dunn hat trick history. So here's a twist on this. This is, and the reason I came up with this, I don't know, way back when, is, you know, the spike in three true outcomes. Home run environment had gone up. Obviously, strikeouts have had a big spike. We've embraced walks a little bit more as a hitter outcome. There is the other end of this as well. Guys who just put the ball in play, your Luis Arizes. There is someone right now who is tracking for, in modern history, we'll say, the opposite of this. Like, the most balls in play, the fewest three true outcomes. So this is, I set the filter to a minimum 300 plate appearances so far this year. This person has only 39 combined home runs, walks, and strikeouts on the year. Do you know who this player is?
No. Okay, hold on. I need to think about this because I have my stat head search up on my screen, but I looked at it the other way. I looked at games without a homer.
Okay, no, this is on the season. This is your total season batting line. Someone who is just doesn't strike out, doesn't walk, has hit a couple homers, but obviously not enough to make up for the lack of strikeouts and walks.
I mean, Luis Arraez has got to be my pick, but number two on that list is Ernie Clement.
It is Ernie Clement. Yeah, he has he is near the very bottom of the league. He has the lowest walk rate in the entire league, and he has the second lowest strikeout rate in the entire league. And then he has 7 home runs, which is not bad for that hitter type, but obviously not going to move you up much on the board there. It's crazy. Even nobody puts nobody puts the ball in play more often than Ernie Clement. He is Mr. Right. Entertainment. This is what the fans want. Absolutely. This is what baseball is trying to legislate back in. We need more Ernie Clements.
Well, and also don't sleep on IKF. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa has 49 games without either a walk home or a strikeout, which is tied for 9th in the league. So you got 2 Blue Jays pretty high on that list.
Who is first this year in games without a true outcome?
Oh, it's Arraez. He's 12 ahead of Clement. He's head and shoulders above everybody else.
Yeah, his sky-high walk rate of 3% maybe threw me off there. I guess, too, he plays way more than Ernie Clement is until very recently as well. Davey, I know you have some other I won't call it nonsense, but it's partial nonsense coming up at Fangraphs. As well, looking forward to that. We're just about out of time here, but why are you examining fouls that catch an umpire and catchers in the throat? What is this sickness?
I just happened to watch a game and somebody foul tipped a ball off the umpire's throat, and it's a bizarre, so you have to foul tip it straight into the ground and it has to bounce straight up and get behind the face mask. It's an insane thing, and I had never seen it before, except that I had. It's a long story. I remembered a story that I read on the back of a baseball card. And so I went searching for whose baseball card was that. I tried to find it. I couldn't find it. I reached out to people on Twitter. No one could remember. And so I started looking through newspapers and I found hundreds of stories about people getting a foul tip in the throat. Apparently it happens constantly. So now I'm working on an article about the history of foul balls to the throat. And oddly, right as I started researching this, my own throat started hurting and it turned out I had COVID. So it was weird. I might've been asking for this.
No, that's the different means of pain there. I'm sorry to hear that. You feeling better now?
I'm starting to.
Okay. Okay. This is, look, the only reason we could do all this stuff on Zoom is because of that era of things. So we can do this safely. I appreciate you gutting it out and doing this for us, man.
Yeah, of course. Also, I know you have Patrick Dubuque coming up. I've never met him, but he's one of my favorite baseball writers, so please give him my best.
Yeah, and every time he's come on, I give him compliments from other people or from myself, and he gets uncomfortable with them. So I will pass that on, Davey. Thanks so much, man.
I'm so excited to join that club.
All right. Davey Andrews of Fangraphs, researcher at MLB Network, also in the band Subway Ghosts, who we're checking all the boxes again this week because we've got Mike Petriello on tomorrow and we had Michael Clara last week. So we're cooking here with the Subway Ghosts. All right, let's take a break. Let's talk to Patrick Dubuque on the other side. Let's talk about what we're looking for in the doldrums of the season here. Obviously, the most exciting time in baseball if you're a good team, if you're in a pennant race, if you're in a playoff race, less so if you are the Chicago White Sox, the Colorado Rockies, even the Toronto Blue Jays. Patrick Dubuque on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A little knock loose playing us back. Saw them a Slipknot on Saturday. They were unbelievable. Also unbelievable. One of our favorite guests, and I'm going to lavish him with compliments because last time it made him a little uncomfortable. Craig Goldstein brings him up. Davey Andrews just brought him up. Your favorite writer's favorite writer of Baseball Prospectus, it's Patrick Dubuque. Patrick, good morning, man. Thank you for doing this.
Good morning, man. That's a rough start. How are you doing, Blake?
I'm good, man. I'll pivot hard off of that since, that's making you awkward here a little bit. Okay. We talked a little bit earlier with Louis Paulus about the 6-inning limit that Major League Baseball has kicked around or leaked out there. We don't need to get too much into the weeds of this one other than you had tweeted out that your main take on it is that, putting constraints on guys is an interesting thing to do. What makes you feel that way?
well, this isn't the one, right? And no. I think that that's been the chorus since the news came out. My problem is that aesthetically speaking, everybody has their own values about what they want the game to look like. My personal preference is that I miss fatigue. I miss when pitchers had to struggle, and that it's kind of interesting how the game is a marathon, right? The sport in general is a marathon, but each individual game, there's very little that actually feels like a marathon in it. Baseball isn't that exhausting on a 3-hour basis, except that starting pitcher who has to try and gut it out back when he had to. And now we don't. We figured out that as a sport, we learned that actually it's worse when they do that. I sympathize with a desire to return to that ideal. And I'd like to figure out a way to do it. This rule is, you know, ham-fisted, and you know, we'll never get out of committee, honestly. But having the idea of having starters just be better than relievers, and having you want to stick with your starter because he was still better than the guy in the bullpen that we had back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, that was good. That was interesting strategically. And, you know, unless we have like 10 teams of expansion so that we can thin out the pitching talent, so that not everybody, because right now it feels like every pitcher can pitch. Pitching feels too easy. But there's not going to be a real easy solution for it.
No, I don't know. And like the expansion, it, to me, is an interesting idea as someone who is wearing an Expos hat right now and fires up out of the park baseball and is immediately like, all right, let's expand to 32, 4 divisions of 8. Let me run an expansion team instead of running the Blue Jays or something like that. That would be one way to kind of dilute the talent pool. So there's, you know, maybe there's more offense that way because there are fewer good pitchers and the pitching talent pool is richer than the hitting one. We used to see that in September all the time because rosters would expand as large as 40. You could call up anyone on your 40 man. And there was a lot of, we'll call it low fidelity baseball that we were getting in September. Hey, yeah, Gabe Gross hit like 8 home runs, but did he hit them off major leaguers or did he hit them off AAA pitching? That's not the case now. What are you looking for when it comes to teams who are out of it down the stretch here? I know you wrote about the Rockies and White Sox recently. We'll talk about those teams. We'll talk about it in the context of the Jays as well. But for teams that don't have that playoff push, and your writing does seem to lean toward the teams that don't have that playoff push lately, what are you looking for? What most interests you the rest of the way here?
I mean, the Blue Jays, you know, to bring them up now, they are the best and most boring version of what can happen in a late season team, which is that it's just straight auditions, right? You are running it back in 2025. You've got a bunch of young players that you haven't seen before and you want to see what you have in them. And that's what you get to do. And that's fine. Like, it's the most boilerplate answer for how to deal with this time of the year. The truth is that baseball isn't very good at this. Like, it's not really designed for us to be doing these extended tryouts because it's kind of the watch pot syndrome. Like, individual games are for winning. You can't see progress on a game by game basis. And if you do, you'll go insane. If you're trying to say, is Joey Lamprofito good now? Well, it's been 4 plate appearances since the last time you looked. You have to not look. You have to just let him play and let him learn and not track it constantly, which is why the minor leagues are great. But for most teams, you just kind of, you know, you still have to try and hope for winning. And you just take your 40% of your wins and enjoy the moments that you get them. And then let the progress happen in the background and then be pleasantly surprised when it happens instead of just like worrying about it every single second. Or you can be the Rockies and just have 7 run innings every so often for no reason for both teams. And then you can just have chaos.
Yeah, you can try to figure out, hey, is Victor Vodnik good or does someone have to pitch the 9th inning and occasionally the Rockies won't collapse? It's a weird one, man. What did you make of the Elias Diaz release? Like I get it. There wasn't much of a trade market for him, and maybe you put him through waivers to see if someone will claim it and eat the salary. But then you just release him after. I don't know, man. It feels like this is for a front office that is often criticized for the lack of a coherent plan and data and everything like that. It just seems like another one of those.
It was such a weird move for Elias Diaz because the Rockies never do this. Like, first of all, they never try and save $1 million. They don't care. They will happily pay a player that they like to play. They don't ever let go of these guys. And it looked like, you know, the some kind of salary cap shenanigans that the Angels did last year at first blush, because that's what when the Angels started releasing everybody so they could barely get under the cap so they could save themselves like $4 million or whatever it was, which is just not how the Rockies operate. It turns out they just needed the room, right? They wanted to call up Drew Romo. That was their only major league ready prospect who caught, and Jacob Stallings somehow is like an actual good hitter for the first time in his career. No one knows why. So they just didn't have a third spot for him. And so it seemed like it was 4D chess, but it was really just 2D chess. It was just, we need a spot. We don't have room. And Diaz was hitting terribly since the beginning of July, which is not a good enough reason. You know, 6 weeks is not a good enough reason to make any kind of roster decision. Diaz will end up as being the backup catcher on some other team. He's good enough to be, you know, better than James McCann. He's better than Brian Serban. But, you know, that's where he is at this point. And he's always kind of been that guy. Like, yeah, he made the All-Star team, but, he's a backup catcher.
Yeah, which is, this is the catching position and this is the heater you get. Like, Santiago Espinal was an All-Star a couple years ago. Sometimes these things happen. Bigger picture, with respect to the Rockies, like, there are, like, car crash fascinating a little bit. But what do you make of, and I guess not what do you make of it, because they are who they are, but I just find it so interesting that even in the Humidor era, there's probably no team that competitively should have leaned more into data and sports science and analytics and pitch, you know, seam shifted wake, what does that look like and things like that, because of they play in an environment that is one of one, and they seem to be among the most regressive teams. How big a missed opportunity do you think that is? Like even in the modern era when there are 28 teams who do this stuff to some degree, I'm leaving out the Rockies and the White Sox here a little tongue in cheek, but like they could, that wouldn't make them take them from what they are to a World Series team, but they are leaving a lot on the table, right? Not maximizing the most unique environment in baseball.
Right. They used to try. I think there was a certain level of fatigue within ownership after trying. Like, they had the four-inning piggyback starter thing that they tried for a little bit, and they gave it up real quick because it turns out that it's even harder to find eight starters than it is to find five starters. But there used to be experiments, and they would oversteer and go, oh, we're only going to get Aaron Cook. We're only going to get sinker baller guys. Okay, no, wait a minute. They put the ball in play, and as soon as the ball is in play, it flies out of the park. We need to only get strikeout guys. Oh, wait a minute. You can't strike anybody out because the pitches don't bend. It feels like they used to try. But then the real problem here is that the Rockies have always been an incredibly successful franchise when it comes to attendance. And you can almost understand why they do have this. They want to be the Rockies more than they want to be good. And you can start to see it when this year the Rockies are 14th in attendance. After a 100-loss season, heading into a 100-loss season, they sell tickets because everyone just likes to go to the games. It's a nice park. It's a pleasant experience. You know all the guys on the team. You can buy their jerseys because you know they're going to stick around. It's like kind of admirable in a way. Like it's one of the few anti-tanking teams. They're just happy to be here. And you know, I get it. Even if it's not good for people who want them to win. They'll provide you that satisfying product that you've always wanted and always got, and it'll never change.
All right. Well, anti-tanking is, I guess tanking involves intent, right? This is,
yeah, exactly.
This is Hanlon's razor. Don't attribute to malice what is better explained by stupidity. I guess the last question for this one is Bud Black okay? Because you've posted some screenshots in your pieces. He's the guy that I worry about.
I don't really know what a manager does, and we're not really supposed to know what a manager does. Almost everything the manager does is supposed to be behind the screen, in the office, in the background. We shouldn't know that much about how they work, because if we know how much they work, that's Pedro Grifol, and you're better off not knowing. That said, one thing we do know that the manager has to do is talk to the press after the game, and I feel so bad for some of these guys who have to come out after the relievers have given up seven runs an inning, and you just have to find a new way to explain why baseball continues to be the exact same way it was every single game up to now. he's got to retire. He's 67 years old. Like, give the man a break.
Yeah. What are you doing this to him for at this point? So it's, I don't know. It's a tough one. I guess the White Sox at least did the nice thing and let Pedro Grifol go. Grady Sizemore has taken over here and he's 2-6. So I know this isn't your project, but you guys at Baseball Prospectus have been ranking the 52 most dominated teams of all time. How are these White Sox looking? Like, are we rewriting this list the second it's done?
So I think they're going to put a piece next week about it as kind of a prequel. And then we'll do the final ranking after the season ends. But yeah, I mean, I don't want to know. I want to be surprised as an editor. I can't wait for that piece to show up and see where they land. It's got to be, you know, top five at the very, very least. I mean, we on there, number four is the recent Orioles tanking team, right? The post Machado team. And this is teams way worse than that. and they're going to be bad forever. That's the big thing, is that, like, the White Sox, this is the first post tanking team. This is the first time that we have new rules in place to keep teams from doing this. And they're doing it anyway, partially because they just don't care, and partially because they, you know, they've got all of these problems institutionally. They're going to draft 10th this year, right? They're not going to be able to rebuild very quickly. We're going to be staring at, this is going to be the first team that's going to be bad for longer than our traditional 3 or 4 year tanking cycles. We haven't had this kind of perpetually bad team for a long time. It'll be interesting.
It will be interesting. And, like, they don't have a lot of money on the books next year if they decline certain options and things like that, but it's a long way back. So one of the things that you wrote about this team recently was that Pecota, your projection system at Baseball Prospectus that you guys use, missed on them by a lot. And I mean, the main reason is that, like, no projection system is going to look at any team and be like, yeah, they'll win 40 games. Like, it's just not possible. But when a team does miss like that, and I know Pecota missed on the Orioles in the opposite direction last year. They missed on the Blue Jays this year, but that's more because, like, you know, the Jays' low outcome was like, oh, maybe they win like 77 games. What the thing can't take into account is like, well, maybe the Jays are on pace for 77 wins and they trade 8 guys away.
Right.
How do we contextualize that when something like this happens? Do we just, hey, there is a percentile outcome below zero?
Right. Well, the funny thing is that I think Pecota still projects the White Sox to be like a 96 loss team going forward. That's what's fascinating. Yeah, exactly. Much, much better. They still think the White Sox are just a mediocre, bad team. And the reason is that they think that the combination of Vaughn and Benintendi and Robert and, like, the core, it still thinks the core of that team is fine. None of them hit. None, not a single one. Like, I love, my favorite fun fact about the White Sox is Iwan Makata has the highest baseball reference war on the team, and he hasn't played since April 9th among position players. But, like, it still thinks that tomorrow Luis Robert's going to be fine. Like, Pecota is designed to not care about yesterday any more than 3 months ago, right? Or 6 months ago or last year. And so it's struggling to think that baseball players fall off a cliff, as we've, you know, seen George Springer, sorry. But you can't just assume they will in any given year. It's kind of an actuarial dilemma. Like, you're likely to die someday. Almost guaranteed, but you're never guaranteed to die in a given year, and you're certainly never guaranteed to have every single position player die in the same year, which is what's kind of happened to the White Sox. It's kind of incredible.
It's quite a morbid way to put it, but yes, actuarially, that is a good analogy, I guess. We know these things will happen, but yeah, it's like the, to put it less morbidly, it's like a home run. Like, in no, you're likely to hit 30 home runs if you're a 30 home run hitter, but in no single at bat are you likely to hit a home run. Right. Is maybe less depressing.
Yeah, if you don't want to go with, like, food poisoning route, but
yeah. Yeah. We'll go with this. Okay. Let's pivot off of this. You've been doing an exercise called TA94 where you're going back and you're reanalyzing some 1994 transactions, obviously the 30-year anniversary of those, through the lens that we use in modern times. And I'm interested what your takeaways were from doing that exercise, but I am wearing an Expos hat today with intent. The bigger question I have for you as you go back and you analyze that lost season is, were they robbed of the World Series? Were they headed for a championship?
Well, wait, the 94 Expos are a weird team. They had two good hitters that year.
So they're like, the Yankees.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. It was Larry Walker and Moises Alou. You know, Cliff Floyd was great, except he was 21 at the time. And he wasn't quite there yet. It's a fascinating team. I think that they were the best team in baseball. I think that because of the way the strike was, or the way that it was looming, a lot of teams didn't improve themselves. There was, like, what's one of the fascinating things about the 1994 is that there was no deadline. Like, the strike didn't happen until after the deadline, but everyone knew it was coming and there were no trades.
Huh.
So none of the teams that were kind of good really pushed themselves forward, and the Expos didn't need to make any trades because they were already, like, crushing the league. So that kind of made them look even better. It's also interesting, like, the Expos had a rotation. Ken Hill, like, one of the most successfully forgotten pitchers of his generation. Nobody remembers Ken Hill. Jeff Fassero at 31 somehow was already 31. He had a great, like, one of his great all-time seasons. Kind of, like, it was Pedro Martinez, and then most people would be challenged to think of a second pitcher for that 94 Expos team, unless you're a big Kirk Ruder fan. Just a kind of a weird magical season, and it's a shame that they didn't get, obviously it's a shame that they didn't get their run, but they had some real 2021 Giants vibes, honestly, as far as, you know, everybody's peak season coming at the same time.
It's a fascinating one, and a fun what if to play out. I was a child, but I shouldn't admit this on a Jay show, but I was more of an Expos kid than a Blue Jays kid, which was, I think, mostly me just being a bit of a contrarian as a kid. Okay, when we look at this year, and we've only got a couple minutes left with you here, Patrick, but with respect to those Pecota projections and things like that, there are three teams that Pecota looks at and seems to say, yeah, this team has a reasonable shot at the World Series. It's the Yankees, it's the Phillies, it's the Dodgers, and then you would still take the field over those three teams, because that's what happens in our current playoff format. But how do you feel about, like, is there a very good team this year, or is it a deeper field of, yeah, they're kind of good teams?
No, there's no great team this year. Part of it is that just injuries have hit the right teams for everything to feel kind of leveled off. The Dodgers have been, you know, completely decimated by injury this year. The Brewers, like, admirable as they have been building their team, they've had to suffer a lot of setbacks as well. The other thing is that I feel like teams have gotten better. Like, this was a very active trade deadline, right? But it was an active trade deadline in the sense of speckling. A lot of teams kind of filled holes rather than tried to go all in. And the team that maybe went the most all in has completely fallen apart since the deadline, the Seattle Mariners. It feels like everybody is trying to be a 90-win team, which is better than everyone trying to be an 85-win team, which is what, you know, people were terrified of with when this new playoff format happened. But everyone's just trying to be pretty good. And the teams that are better than that have kind of been pulled back into the race. The thing is that the postseason will decide for us, right? We'll have some magical team in the postseason. And if they have a Braves second half, or they have, you know, last year's Diamondbacks but win, we won't think about any of this thing. They'll just be the team of destiny, and it'll be fine. We won't care how they did in April or May. If the Padres continue to somehow be what this Padres team suddenly is, no one will think, oh, this is actually the Padres team that spent the most time at 500 of any Padres team ever, which is what they did for the first 3 months of the season. The most 500 team ever in the Padres, being the most Padres possible, and then suddenly going on an insane heater and just running it.
Yeah, the takeaway from the Padres is we need 324 game seasons, because then the 2023 and 2024 Padres would make perfect sense together as one big unit.
I mean, this team is really like the sequel, the continuation of last year's ideals, but actualized. Yeah.
It's fun. They're fun right now. Good for AJ Preller going fantasy football manager mode and just tweaking and tweaking and tweaking. Patrick, we got to let you go here, man. We're wrapping up for the day. Thanks so much for taking the time out, and keep up all the great work.
Yeah, thanks. It's always a pleasure.
Patrick Dubuque of Baseball Prospectus. Ton of great work from him over at BP. Make sure you're checking that out. Let's get you set up for game one of this series, which has a mystery starter for the Cincinnati Reds. Hunter Greene hit the IL over the weekend with arm soreness. They did call up Legumina, who's a multi-inning reliever, but he threw 32 pitches yesterday, so don't imagine he's in the mix for a heavy workload today. They do have six fresh bullpen arms, eight guys who probably have a yellow to green light in terms of availability, so they could just have Jake Junis lead a bullpen day. Also possible they dip into the minors. Hey, old friend Yosfer Zulueta is on the 40-man there. They've also got a couple AAA starters on the 40-man, including Liam Richardson. Don't know when he pitched last, so you know possibly he's in the mix there as well. The headline item on the hitter side is Ellie De La Cruz, one stolen base away from joining a very rare 20-homer, 60-stolen base club. He'll try to do it against Kevin Gausman, who comes in off of his first time going seven innings or more in consecutive starts in over a calendar year. Got to go back to May 2023 against Baltimore, against the Angels. He only gave up two runs over 15 innings combined over those starts, but they were a lot more pitch to contact oriented than swing and miss oriented, which is a little different way for Kevin Gausman to succeed. We'll see how that goes against the Reds team that's seen him a little bit, but not a ton. Ty Francis 5-for-15 against him, and then it's a bunch of guys who have seen him, you know, one game here, one game there. This is not a bad Reds team. They're four games under 500. Their playoffs playoff chances are on life support here, so they need to win badly. Should be a fun one down at Rogers Center. We will be back to talk to you tomorrow. Thanks to Arden, Louie, Davey, Patrick, Amit, Armin, and Jennifer.